Welcome, folks, to season 5 of Mention and Dispatches, the official that official podcast of the Armchair Dragoons. And tonight we are going to be talking Cold War wargaming. And to do that, we brought in a pair of guests this week. The first one, a returning guest here, Ian, the Rocky Mountain Navy guy. Ian, how you doing tonight?
I'm awesome, Brant. How are you all doing?
We're doing fine here. And so Ian, of course, has written a handful of those naval Cold War wargaming kinds of things for us. And tonight we're going to get him to talk about it some. Also joining us, possibly one of the two or three more distinguished guys we've had on Mentioned in Dispatches, which says way more about him than it does about us. Bart is here. Bart is one half of the author team of the Northern Fury Cold War Goes Hot novel, soon to be series. I guess you'll tell us all about that here in a second. But Bart, welcome.
Thank you very much, Brent.
So let's get it out of the way up front. The next book in the Northern Fury series, you joked about it's not coming soon enough, but what's the next thing we're going to see from the Northern Fury sort of literary world here, and when might we see it?
So we're working on a novella to basically a side story out of book one, H.R., which follows the Norwegian Coast Guard cutter Nordkapp on its attempted escape out of Binnock in North Norway with a bunch of evacuees on board.
Okay.
So we're hoping to get that out. I'm not going to say by Christmas, but I'm going to say sometime this winter.
Winter is coming.
Yeah, well, it's Labor Day, and in Canada, we're just starting to get ready for it already.
Yes. I imagine you guys are completely thrown for a loop, given that it's, you know, playoff hockey in August and September.
It's all messed up, man.
I had to walk out of the room where I was watching the Islanders Flyers game, which will tell everybody when we're recording this. I was watching Islanders Flyers as I had to come out here and record. And since I don't have a cable box out in the office, I'm not able to keep up with the game while we're recording here.
Yeah, that's, you don't have a team worth watching there anyway. So
au contraire, mon frère. Yeah, we're not going to get into my team versus your team here, but mine does have a Stanley Cup since the last time any Canadian team won.
Yeah, okay.
I'm not wrong.
No, you're not.
This week, we're going to be talking Cold War wargaming, and we're talking Cold War wargaming both on the waves and up in the air, because the last couple of times we've talked Cold War wargaming here on Mention and Dispatches, we primarily talked ground combat stuff. In large part because, look, I'm your host. I was a tank dude. I grew up in the Cold War, but I was an armor officer for a while. So, like, the, you know, ground combat stuff is what I know. But it's also what the other podcast cadre at the time were also far more into. And so, you know, we did an entire episode around the World at War 85 game release and the series and talking Cold War land combat. Then we did another one earlier on, again, just because it's something we're all interested in. But we wanted to bring in a couple of guys to talk other parts of Cold War wargaming. And so there's really two kinds of, there's a bit of a split in all this that I want to talk with you guys. And Ian, you'll probably kind of understand where this split is. I think there was a whole bunch of Cold War wargaming while the Cold War was going on, right? We had the Victory Games Fleet series. We had Air War. We had all kinds of Foxbat and Phantom. We had a bunch of different stuff. And then the Cold War ended, and we all, you know, all us wargamers kind of looked around at each other and sort of shrugged and go, well, what the hell do we do now? And now, you know, 25 years after the Cold War ended, we're sort of going back to the past a little bit. And I get that some of it's in vogue now just because U.S. and Russia are sort of, you know, playing footsie again. But a lot of the games that we're starting to see released, Ian, you wrote about Blue Water Navy for us, World at War 85, the upcoming, the just released Folded Gap game from Compass Games. These, we're starting to see Cold War Goes Hot making a comeback. And so want to talk about some of the new stuff versus some of the old stuff. So I thought maybe we'd start with some of the old stuff and looking backwards there a little bit. Ian, when we were first talking about doing this show, you sent over a list of, hey, here's a whole bunch of games that I could talk about. Which one off of that list do you have the fondest memories of playing?
I'll probably have to go with the Victory Games Fleet Series. That was really the ones that you could play all around the world, had the wide variety of ships. It felt good to play. It wasn't hard mechanically. But the other game, which is the one that's still out there today, it really has to be Harpoon.
Yeah, yeah.
Started Harpoon back with the old Adventure Games one. I mean, that was written, that was actually with Dave Arneson's company. And then GDW picked it up. Clash of Arms eventually picked it up. But that was the Janes. That was the one that everybody wanted to play because that was all the toys, all the hardware. Can I take my Spruance destroyer and can I hunt your Victor submarine? I mean, that's the way you did it. And in many ways, it was a lot like the air games. It was all about the hardware and just trying to play with the latest toys. So Victory Games, Fleet Series for the whole big fleet battles, and Harpoon, just still to this day, still the number one. A lot like Simano on a computer out there.
Yeah.
So
when you talk Harpoon, are you talking tabletop Harpoon or digital Harpoon?
So I always play the tabletop Harpoon. And I actually, one thing I really loved about when Clash of Arms did it is they provided counters. So I still have my old Nav War miniatures. But I have a collection that I never got around to fully basing, never got around to fully painting. But I could still play the game because folks provided to get counters, and that's really all you need. Nowadays, even you can go to Wargame Vault, and you are online paper counters. You can just set up paper tents and you can go with. And that's really all you needed. I mean, yeah, the miniatures are nice, but the rules can still work with just a couple counters thrown down around a 3x3 table, piece of blue felt for your ocean, and then go at it.
We've had folks play in some of Larry Bond's games at Origins over the years. You know, Larry famously stuck his head in the midst of our Persian incursion game one time. Some folks may remember when we did the Dragoons assembly a couple of weeks ago, I guess we're getting close to a couple months ago at this point, when we had our little online convention. One of the talks we had was University of Maryland professor Dr. Matt Kirschenbaum come in and talk about digital archiving. And the example he used was the example of Harpoon. And it was sort of how do wargamers keep records of the development of all of their information throughout the process of developing a game. And he used Harpoon for two reasons. One, it'd been around a long time, right? It's been through multiple iterations and lots of technical updates. You mentioned all the toys, all the hardware, so lots of those things as a part of that. But the other reason Matt, you know, looked into Harpoon, quite frankly, is he knew Larry Bond, had an opportunity to reach out to Larry Bond, and Larry's there in the D.C. metro area where Matt is, and so he was able to literally drive over to his house and sit down and talk with him about it. We've talked a lot of Harpoon over the years. Bart, Harpoon was one you cut your teeth on early on as well, correct?
Pretty much on the computer side. On the tabletop side, I played the Victory Game 6 and 2nd and 6th Fleet mostly. I didn't get into the Pacific in that, but for tabletop games, they were fantastic. But I think I started playing Harpoon when I got my first computer in, dating myself, 89 here. And that's when Harpoon version 1.0, you might get 10 or 12 minutes out of it before it crashed the system. till it patched it all up, and you had to dial up BBS to somewhere in New York City to get scenarios. But that's where I started cutting my teeth on, really, on naval and air games. Now it's CMO, Mano, and then CMO, and yeah, that's where I stayed. It's been fun.
Well, and it's turned into a second career for you. So, you know, there's always that as a bonus.
Well, yeah, it's, I started designing Command Live scenarios. I think I did four or five of them. And then the spinoff with the book and that. And as we've discussed before, we use the scenarios to add texture to our combat scenes and that. And we don't religiously or slavishly follow the parallel between the scenarios and the book, but it adds a lot of color. And it's a lot of fun.
It's been fun to read. So, you know, off we go. You know, I remember when Joel started out just writing AARs off of his C-Mano games, And everybody's like, oh, my God, this is like reading a book. And then suddenly he's writing a book. And we're like, oh, my God, this is like reading a book. And there we went. Ian, you mentioned the Fleet series of games. And I guess, like everything else, right, these are making a comeback. Somebody's is it Compass Games that's reworking the Fleet series that's bringing
Compass
them back?
Compass Games has the license. They're reworking it.
Yeah. It seems that if there's something being reworked for re-release, the first guess is usually Compass Games, and you're probably right, is what it seems like these days. For the Fleet series, like you mentioned, you know, this is bigger Fleet actions. When we're doing ground combat stuff, obviously at the battalion level and above, hardware matters. Hardware organization, supply, transport, like the nuts and bolts of combat and the math all matters at that level. But once we get down to like platoon level or even individual vehicle level, we can model the capabilities of individual leaders, individual participants, individual commanders. The Lock and Load Tactical Modern series, like when they're doing Cold War stuff, they've got heroes and leaders running around the battlefield doing stuff. On a boat, that's a little tougher, right? Because you've got like a counter representing a destroyer, and whether you've got a really good surface warfare officer, man in a weapon station or not, kind of is a little bit irrelevant, or is it? Like, how much does the crew factor in as a legit factor in a naval war game when you've got an entire boat floating around on that counter there?
I think morale has always been a part of naval war gaming. You go back to even the age of sail ships, you know, what sort of morale you have. A lot of your World War One, World War Two naval games still have crew experience, quality and such. And even when you get into the modern pieces, that's still probably a factor that's worth trying to model somewhere in there. We have a lot of these countries around the world that buy the latest and greatest piece of equipment, but they don't do the training on it. They buy the latest and greatest gadget, but they don't know how it works or how to use it in that system of systems, multi-domain battle space that we're sitting in these days, and we were sitting in during the Cold War too. So modeling some of that individual pieces does make a difference. Maybe you just have a really good crew, the Battle E winner, the best ASW, anti-submarine warfare crew out there for the fleet who's working that day. And that can be worth modeling. But at the same time, yeah, you're right. It's a big piece. You abstract it out. Some games have abstracted it way out. Got a old Sim Canada games from the mid-1980s, Steve Newberg's Battle Stations, really just reduces everything to an A, B, C, D range. When it was showing the maneuver to get you into the range to deliver your pulse of firepower. So there's a lot of ways you can approach it. From a very granular harpoon, hey, you know, this rail is launching this missile, out to something more abstract, like in the Fleet series, or even more abstract, like in Battle Stations, from Steven Newberg.
Yeah, I think it gets into a common philosophy where in the Army we equip the man, and in the Air Force and Navies they man the equipment as well. So I think it's got less of an impact, but you can still do it. Commando does it with, I think there's five levels, almost the ABCD you described. So I think it's important.
You started to go down the road I was about to go for you there, Bart, and that was talking about where some of those things factor in the command series in terms of the caliber or quality of the individual dudes out there. I say dudes, right? There's dudettes out there also. It's just not a very elegant turn of phrase as being expressed verbally. So, but when you've got your folks out there in the field, you know, obviously like the stories you're telling, you're focusing on individual people. It's not just this F-15E flying around. It's Major Smith in the F-15E, because that's the narrative that you guys have to craft as a part of the storytelling. But when you're designing the scenarios in command, how much are you thinking, hey, I need four F-15s, and how much are you thinking, yeah, that's these four specific pilots? I mean, I don't think you can put individual names on the icons floating around out there, can you?
No, well, I guess you could, but we don't. I start with in the scenarios baseline where I can't even remember the levels now, but there's five levels, and the Soviets and the Warsaw Pact start on standard rate or regular. The NATO has got one step up because they do a lot more training and a lot more cohesive. At least that's in my initial assessment. Then I give variances up and down for units. NATO reserve units drop down a bit, et cetera. So that's the starting point for the first scenario. It's actually usually after the first scenario that our characters start popping up. One of our main characters is a Norwegian F-16 pilot, Jan Olsen. Well, that came out of a vignette when Joel was playtesting my scenario H-Hour. Basically, stuff happened where it was pretty amazing. And we tried to recreate that in the first shooting bits of the book. And so Jan became our guy, and now he became an ace in a day, but so did his arch nemesis, Metroshenko. So those guys we will play up in the books, but they've sort of been removed from the scenarios, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, yeah, it does. And I think to an extent, again, given the level at which Command exists as a game, there's only so much individuality you can imbue those icons with that would make it a little tougher to get away with. Whereas you've got to have that individuality to have your readers identify with somebody in the story. So I kind of totally get all that.
More often than not in a scenario, you find yourself attracted to, or at least I do, very specific aircraft or ships that are just having one hell of a good day, and the electrons are all rolling in their favor, and you start watching those guys. And in follow-on scenarios, I'll take an amalgam of that, and I'll add a few more aces into various squadrons based on how they did in previous scenarios. We've got a Danish ship like that, and you can read it in a couple of Joel's AARs, and it'll appear in book two, the Verdine, I think it is. I'm probably mispronouncing that right now. It essentially dodged three missiles and damaged a Yak-141 in the playing scenario. And that's happened more than once. And this thing is very lightly armed. So they become our favorites.
Yeah, I had a long-running Civ AAR one time where I had the dumbest... I had a scout unit, and he was the dumbest scout unit on the planet whenever he was on automated mode. He would just wander right into high-powered barbarian fighters wandering around out there that, like, you already knew they were there, and he would walk directly towards them when I put him in automated mode. But whenever I took him over on manual and would, you know, get him into a fight, he was winning fights he had no business winning. And he became the idiot hero scout dude. That's how I referred to him in all, you know, in capital letters. That was the official title, idiot hero scout dude. And it was ridiculous, some of the stuff that guy pulled off. And so, yeah, he became this long-running favorite in this long-running AAR because he managed to survive throughout all of these years doing absolutely boneheaded, moronic things and still stumbled through them all.
So Brant,
yeah.
I got a question.
Sure.
So it sounds to me a lot like that that your approach using war games in your novels and stuff is a lot like what Larry Bond and Tom Clancy originally did back with Red Storm Rising and Dance of the Vampires. Are you familiar with your talks with Larry? Did you guys talk about that, the use of a harpoon in his Red Storm Rising?
So in the little bit that I've talked with him, we didn't bring that up in part because... Folks, I mean, that story's so well known, you know, throughout, especially the wargaming world, that you know, it's not necessarily something you really need to talk to him about. It's like you've heard it from all kinds of different angles at this point. How many more times does he need to tell that story? What has been interesting in the limited interactions that I've had with Larry, what it really comes across with is I think he likes the stories that the war games can tell as the battle's unfolding, when he's watching the battle unfolding as the GM and he's sort of kind of describing for the players what's going on, or that time he was there with us at the Persian incursion game and he was sort of following the action that was going on with all the different people we had in there, because it wasn't two guys sitting over a Persian incursion table. We had like a team war game going on where most of the participants, 7, 8, 9 of them, were all on the Israeli side, and so you had the the Israeli government. You had an intel guy. You had the strike planner. You had the maintenance guy who was responsible for turning around the aircraft, getting them back out. We had a dude whose only job was the search rescue downed aircraft, you know, downed crew recovery kind of guy. And then our guys were playing the op for. And kind of the narrative that was being crafted and all that was something that he really seemed to be getting into and was very interested in sort of how the story was being told, but how the story was being told because it was the story that seemed to make it more fun for the participants, right? It wasn't this very sterile environment of just sort of moving these faceless counters around. Like, we got an air crewman down behind enemy lines somewhere. Oh my God, we got to rescue this dude before he gets captured. You know, and somebody even brought up in the midst of that game, you know, oh my gosh, if this guy gets captured, there's going to be a huge international incident. And somebody else saying, well, yeah, plus one of our pilots is going to die. You know, like, let's keep the human aspect on these things. And so I think the narrative, you know, again, the limited interactions with the guy, so I don't want to over project here, but the narrative mattered in so much as it helped create enjoyment for the participants. And as long as folks seemed to be having a good time, he was willing to hand wave over whatever else he needed to keep the fun going. And I think that really mattered from a wargaming context. Now, I haven't been around the guy when he's writing novels, right? You know, I've only really interacted with the guy at game conventions. So there's only so much that I've been around him. But that, you know, I think that's true of a lot of us. Like, you know, aside from the professionals, right? And we've dealt with those guys plenty of times on podcasts in the past, and we will again this coming year. We've talked to plenty of professionals who are doing this kind of stuff for a living where the analytical output of their war games actually matters for defense policy purposes and some such. The rest of us are just trying to have a good time, right? So we're hoping to learn something. For many of us, that's part of how we have a good time, is we're learning something. But I think a lot of us, man, like, if we're not having a good time, why are we wasting our time doing this? You know, the professionals will not have a good time, but they're getting paid for it. And so, you know, on a certain level, it's their job, and the output matters. And so if they're not having a great time, they still understand it's important. They do the best they can. The rest of us, man, if we're not having a good time, why? Like, why are we doing this? So I think the fun factor really sort of is what matters in all of this, doesn't it?
It's almost like molding in parts of a role-playing game into a war game, and just identifying with bits of those counters that you're playing with, I think.
Yeah. And you know, going back to, again, some of the ground combat stuff that I'm more familiar with, you know, as soon as you put a name and a face on a counter, it becomes more than just some random counter. Right, that's why you've got leader portraits on those leader and hero counters floating around out there, whether it's squad leader or lock and load tactical or whatever. You know, I remember SPI's old Air War game. I mean, there were, I don't know, probably 80 different kinds of aircraft in that game. I mean, there were a crap ton of counters in there, but every one of them was just this very sterile F4, F16, F14. Whatever designation, you know, MiG-19, they weren't personalized in any way. They were individual aircraft counters, but they were in no way personalized at all, that I recall. In your own mind, you could say, oh yeah, that was this dude, but it's not explicitly built into the game the way it is in some other games that we may play. So
players don't have to be limited by that. That specific game, a group of my friends and I, we tried to apply a sort of a squadron system over top of it. I think one of the World War One air games had something like that, like Wings or Rick Dobbins War or something like that. And so we did apply names to those aircraft, and we assigned them to successive missions, etc. And you can do it.
I was just saying, interestingly enough, I'm going to let Ian ask you a question. I'm going to walk across the room because I have my old TSR Dawn Patrol sitting in here. I'm curious what that one says on the aircraft. I'm going to walk across the room and grab it. Ian, whatever you're about to ask, ask Bart.
Okay. So it wasn't so much a question, but more of a comment. I think this is where the modern-day Cold War gaming benefits from advances in publications. You're right. The old TSR... The old SPI games had those very sterile, generic counters. I mean, even air superiority or speed of heat from the 80s and 90s still had, A, B, C, D identifiers on our counters. But you move into some newer generation, look at Downtown GMT games, and you have individual flights. You have Diamond Flight, you have Maverick Flight, The advances in publications has given them more than that, you know, horrible color palette that SPI worked with for so many years.
That's right.
They did great stuff with it, but it was still, you know,
pretty limited.
Yeah, I pull out my copy of Victory in the Pacific, and I just sort of gag, but it's a great game, but it looks horrible on the table. But more modern games, the more modern work is, we get so much more benefit out of it. We get so much more enjoyment out of it, partially because we've just come so far in publishing.
Yeah, and I think also in design concept and philosophy, I think people have learned from those games and have discovered what we're talking about, is that people get more engaged if they're more enthralled with and involved with those little cardboard counters. And any mechanism or any trick you can do to make that better is good, and I think people are learning how to do that. Yeah.
So I just grabbed Dawn Patrol, and it identifies the aircraft by name of aircraft. It is a top-down view, but it's not a silhouette view, and there are places in there where there is the same aircraft label, but the paint schemes are different enough that you can uniquely identify each of those counters separately from the other. So you don't have names on them, but they are all uniquely identifiable, for whatever that's worth.
Yeah, what we had done in that case was we developed squadron rosters, and we took blank counters and put names on them, put the pilots underneath the counters, and then if you got shot down, you lost them. I think we had some sort of random roll for survival and all that as well, but it's been a long time. So
hey, if it works, it works. Right?
Yeah, well, yeah, we did a lot of that, just sort of taking the standard games and modifying them. But I'm sure a lot of people did that.
Yeah, yeah.
So somewhere on DriveThruRPG, I think there's a role-playing game, and you're a mercenary fighter squadron, going around the world fighting stuff, and it leans heavily into that theme. You have individuals, and you have your own call signs, and you follow your campaign and everything. That's an easy craft to add on to almost any of your air warfare games out there, to give it some more personalization.
Well, you know, WizKids did that with the Crimson Skies series. You know, it's an alt history game, I get that, but that was exactly what WizKids did with the Crimson Skies series as well. I do want to ask a question, and Ian, I know you specifically have played some Air War over the years. Bart, I'm not sure if you have or not. Did you ever make it through two consecutive turns of Air War in a single sitting?
Yes.
Really?
Once.
So you're the one.
Air War, the one game I remember, was a totally made-up scenario of, I think it was F-105s versus backfire bombers off of New York or something like that. And all I remember is getting the backfire bomber. I was the Ruskies. All I remember is getting the backfire bomber all the way down on the deck, trying to turn and burn. And the F-104 can't turn and burn, but still it's fast. It's slashing in. And I put the plane into the water, you know, just because I ran out of altitude, airspeed, and ideas. But yeah, I made it through, but I think the whole battle only represented about, you know, 6-7 seconds of fight.
Yeah.
But it took us a day to do it.
I can remember more than a few times getting the game set up, getting the two, you know, and just to try and make sure we understood the rules, we'd put like one airplane for each of us on either side of the map and say, all right, let's see who can shoot who down. And like an hour and a half later, we've moved three hexes. I'm like, this is dumb. I mean, like, I don't know if we were just too dumb to figure it out, or if it just defeated us with its complexity. But I mean, it was so hard to get anything accomplished in that game; it just drove us nuts. So,
well, I think that's where we're seeing now some of the, I hate the phrase, but for lack of a better phrase, elegance in game design. People are focusing. There's still some games out there. Look at what was it, Birds of Prey?
Yeah.
It goes heavy, heavy, heavy into the modeling of an individual airplane in flight and stuff. But there's more games out there. I'll go back to the Downtown Elusive Victory and Red Storm series. It's more operational. The planes move. You're moving around. You're not fighting the airplanes. You're fighting the battle.
Yeah.
And getting that sort of design elegance, I think, is one of the advantages of the evolution of the Cold War gaming. We're getting away from the hardware and getting more into how it all works together.
Yeah, and I think that's definitely a difference that I've noticed. You know, I mentioned at the start of all this kind of those two waves of games, like the original stuff from the 70s and 80s when the Cold War was going on, and the stuff now looking back 25 years. Now, again, direct comparisons aren't fair, right? Because we've got a quarter century of development of wargame design since then as well that have given us a lot of good ideas that we can run with. I do think you're right in that we've gotten a lot less hardware-centric, particularly on the tabletops, than we were back in the 70s and 80s. And I wonder if it's not at least partly Bart's fault. And Bart, here's why. Being able to digitize the complexity has sort of moved the rivet counters into the digital world, right? Because now there's almost nothing you can't model somehow, some way. Whereas on the tabletop, you don't need to get to that level of detail in the modeling, because if you want that level of detail, there's this computer game to go play instead. And it gets back to what you're saying. Let's capture the appropriate feel of it. Let's tell the story without getting bogged down into too many details. Bart, what do you think? Am I way off base here?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean to get the absolute detail and all that, I mean, Flight Simulator scratched that itch in many ways. You move up the scale and you determine what exactly you're trying to achieve with this game or game model or game system or whatever. And designers, I think, have gotten much better at doing that. But, as you alluded, I mean, to us, it's all about the story, and it's all about the scenarios are designed for CMO, are all about laying out the campaigns in the various theaters and the background text that I give in the orders and the messages and all that and the events feed events that I want to happen in the books. Now, they may not roll out that way, but that doesn't really matter. It just gives clues as to what might happen in the books when they eventually get written. To us, it's all about the story, and when I'm designing scenarios, that's what I'm focusing on. CMO is flexible enough in most ways that allows me to do that.
Well, that's a good thing.
Yeah, so. It's frustrating enough as well sometimes, but generally flexible.
Ian, you mentioned speed of heat a while back. I know a lot of folks have spoken glowingly of Speed of Heat over the years. What was your impression of it? Was it more good than bad? And what was it that you did or didn't like about that one in particular?
I like Speed of Heat. It was built off of the original Air Superiority system. It's J.D. Webster's system. What I really liked about that system, his fighting wings and Fighting Wings World War II series, and then his Air Superiority Speed of Heat for the more modern age, it explained much better energy management and flying, whereas Air War was very technical and got it all down. I never really grokked why you were doing certain things, but in the Speed of Heat, you had horizontal flight points and vertical flight points, and you started understanding, okay, this is making me go forward, this is making me going up and down, and this is how I changed to make those things work differently. So it started getting more, a better understanding of the energy management game, which is really what comes down to air combat. It's really, you know, who has altitude is energy, speed is energy, and who can maneuver to put their nose around the right way or to get into the right shooting parameters is all about how you expend your energy. I think we just saw a lot of that right now in this whole, this last week, DARPA with their AI challenge. A lot of folks saying, hey, the AI beat the pilots. Like, well, the AI played the energy management game faster and better. And Speed of Heat allowed you to do that too. You could understand better what was going on, and it became a bit more intuitive, and it made sense, and it flowed.
You mentioned the DARPA thing. As interesting as that is, I don't want to dig into it too much because I don't want to take the time away from talking about some of the Cold War stuff that we've got. One of the other ones you mentioned, Birds of Prey. Go ahead.
So pause here a moment. the other game, when you were talking about energy management, the one that I think doesn't get enough credit is actually Flight Leader. It came out in the mid-80s, early mid-80s. You'll find the phrase OODA loop in some of the articles, but it really was maybe the first of the air war games that sort of embraced John Boyd's theories of the OODA loop, observe, orient, detect, or decide, act. Observe, orient, decide, act. They changed the scale. Gary Morgan was an Air Force pilot. He changed the scale. Instead of doing that microseconds like air war or a couple seconds like air superiority, speed of heat, he changed it to more like, I want to say it's like a 10, 15 second, maybe even 30 second snapshot of time. And the whole battle became energy management, still was energy management, but it was more upon that whole look at what's going on, orient yourself as to what you're doing in the aircraft, and then decide and act and then see what happens there. So that was a change. You take that to the other extreme, or take that to the extremeness, is Birds of Prey with their nomograms. And it's in there shooting those nomograms that tells you how you're... You ask if I played Air War. Yes, I did. I've tried Birds of Prey several times, and everyone tells me it's easy once you get it, but I haven't made it past over that hurdle yet. But for a 3D air game, everyone's... as wow, this is the ultimate. But I think we could circle right back to what we were talking about before. Do we need the ultimate paper model, or is it better to go with a computer simulation at that point?
Yeah, I was going to bring up Birds of Prey here in a minute also, in that one of the interesting parts that I find about Birds of Prey, and so I know Ken over at Astra, they'd actually published a book of mine at one point through Final Sword Productions. Ken's a great dude. One of the things that I've always found interesting about Birds of Prey is it is essentially the exact same system that they use for spaceship combat, or really, really darn close in terms of the relative movement of the aircraft to each other is what really determines the target profile, where you hit it, what kind of damage you do. While the maneuvering can be a bit of a challenge, like you said, I mean, there are some complexities in there. You really gotta, the nuances you have to master. But the combat system in terms of what'd you hit, where'd you hit, how hard you hit, like, it's, you know, I'm at this angle to this dude, which means from here I count this number of boxes over, hit there, and then here's how the damage splashes out. It's actually a fairly elegant system of applying the damage, but it always sort of struck me as almost kind of a reskinned spaceship combat game. And I'm not sure which one came first, whether Birds of Prey came first before the attack vector stuff, to know which one would have influenced the other. The little bit of time that I've spent with Birds of Prey, and again, like, if I'd spent a lot more time with these things, I wouldn't need you guys on the... I need you guys on the call because you're the experts. But Birds of Prey, it always struck me as sort of spaceships with jet engines instead of being in space. Your experience at all comparable to that?
I'm trying to look up right now. So Attack Vector was... Attack Vector Tactical is 2004. Birds of Prey was earlier than that.
Okay.
So maybe Birds of Prey helped lead one to the other.
Okay. All right.
I have played some of the later. I have a Squadron Strike Traveler, and I've been able to figure that one out. It's similar. Yes. No matter what did you do, if you're going to do 3D anything, it's going to have some complexities in it. But for the Cold War games, there weren't any really, I don't recall any really 3D games back other than Birds of Prey. Everything had altitude in it, but not the 3D way like Birds of Prey tried to do it.
Yeah.
Play it a lot, you're probably going to master it and figure it out. But if you're more of a casual gamer and you just pick it up once in a while, it'll be very frustrating.
That awfully similar to submarine games as well, where you're dealing in three dimensions. It's a little differences, of course, but
similarities, yes. I equate submarine games more to like your World War One air combat games. The speed of maneuver is much slower, and it just doesn't have that instantaneous. Some of your Cold War games and modern era games, when you're trying to snap that nose around right away, it just seems different to me. World War One game, you know, Wings of Glory, submarine game like Avalon Hill's submarine, a lot more slower pace, a lot more easy to manage, easy to understand the system. Where if a true 3D game can get the complexity starts ramping up a lot quicker. There were some 3D games out there, even a flight leader who goes with altitudes and 3D dimensions and such, but it keeps it a lot simpler, I guess, not as many angles to choose from than something like Birds of Prey does.
Bart, did you ping, or you mentioned having played some of the naval stuff earlier, did you ping around much with the air games back during the Cold War years, or did you sort of stick to the waves?
Mostly the waves. I think I played some Foxbat and Phantom way back when. That, I think, was the extent of it. It was mostly the waves, and then once I joined the Army, I got too busy for board games, and that's when I picked up Computer Harpoon, and then, yeah, it's history from there.
And parlayed that into a book career. There you go.
Yeah, exactly. With a couple of gaps in between.
Yeah. I did want to ask if any of y'all had much familiarity with Dan Versen's leader system at all, where you got like Phantom Leader and some of the others, that obviously he's got some ground combat equivalents as well, but the air combat ones are sort of the ones that kind of became a recurring shtick that, you know, originally GMT had published these things. I think it was Hornet Leader and Phantom Leader, and then, you know, later the series has grown from there. Now there's an Apache Leader. There's all kinds of others. There's absolutely some individual names on these things, right? Because you've got to buy who your individual pilots are and what their skills and capabilities are. So that's totally a relevant role-playing-ish tie-in. You can't help but personalize these guys. I've not played the games. I'm familiar with what they are and the concepts of them, but I haven't played them. Have either of y'all played those before, got any experience with them at all? Ian, is that something you've pinged with at all?
I haven't, but they always sit there on the, you know, my wish list and off to the side there for exactly the reasons you mentioned. They are in many ways a very personal game, and it's like, hey, do I want to be that you know, Hornet pilot and roll in on those missions, and can I move through the scenario? Can I execute my you know, maneuver my aircraft and execute to get to the mission objectives? Always been very interesting, partially because it isn't complex flying. You're not sitting there trying to say, okay, I'm going to put in this much rudder and add this much throttle and try to yank my nose around here. But no, it's just it's a lot more abstracted, but yet a lot more personal, which is probably the greatest advantage of those games, personalization. You get invested in it personally because you really are part of it, not just manipulating it. You actually feel much more like you're there.
Bart, I'm guessing it's not something that you futzed with a whole lot over the years, have you?
I played Hornet Leader briefly a few years ago. Didn't catch me, so I didn't dwell on it. But it was interesting, and as Ian says, it focuses more on almost your management of your manpower, your pilots. And I think there's maintenance of the jets included and a series of mission taskings and that. It was interesting, but it just didn't catch on for me.
To each their own. Moving forward to some of the post-Cold War designs that look back at the Cold War itself. Ian, when you wrote the review of Blue Water Navy for the Dragoons, one of the things that you noted was kind of that underlying thought of, yes, this is a game about the naval war in the Atlantic during a Cold War goes hot in Europe scenario. But the reality is that whole thing is a supporting effort to the fact there's a ground war happening in Germany right now. And you can't take your eyes off of the need to support and enable that ground war just because you think it's cool to go chasing subs or whatever other nifty things you can inflict on the waves. Talk to us a little bit about sort of that dichotomy between, hey, I want to go do cool stuff floating around blowing up other ships versus I still got to be careful and take care of, you know, enabling this ground war to take place and for us to win.
I think you've hit upon one of the problems of naval gaming in general is so many times naval gaming gets focused down at the tactical level, and you've got this piece of hardware versus that piece of hardware, and gamers want to be gamers. They go out and they start fighting, and they forget, ignore, don't pay attention to why they're fighting. So you'll end up with, there's always the play the Battle of Trafalgar and how many ships get sunk, and play the Battle of Jutland and how many ships get sunk, play Leyte Gulf and how many ships get sunk, which is probably not what the reality is. Bluewater Navy was nice and explicit. I really appreciate how explicit it was in the victory conditions, in that you can sit there and you can try to sit there and sink every ship you can and such, but what really matters is getting those convoys across the Atlantic and delivering those convoys to support the ground effort. You can sink every ship out there, but if you don't deliver those convoys, you've lost. I went back and I looked at the fleet series because I was going like, wow, this is really new. And I went back and I reread the fleet series and looked at the victory conditions, it actually is the same message is in there. They didn't call it out as nice and neatly as I think Blue Water Navy does, but it's out there. So that really illustrates to me the difference between a tactical game where the victory conditions are sink the other guy, and then getting into these larger operational, if not strategic, games, which is talk more about the mission and why you fight. I mean, I look at my bookshelf here. I got one of the books, Old Navy, How Navies Fight, but really it's Why Navies Fight. What are you trying to do? When is the right time to sacrifice your ship, but when is the right time to hold it back and make sure that the other part of the mission is complete? That's what I really appreciate about Blue Water Navy, and I think some of the more modern, when you talk about more modern games, with the benefit of time and some hindsight, we've been able to call out and say, hey, what were we doing in that Cold War? What do we really want the gamer to try to model and play? What game are we playing? Are we playing that we're just sink my battleship, or are we playing, hey, can I actually support the ground pounders over in Europe and get the supplies through? Because that's the real measure of the success.
Interestingly, is there, or do you know of, and again, naval warfare is not my shtick, but is there a comparable World War II campaign-focused naval warfare game that's not just, let me go sink U-boats, but let me sink U-boats or drive them off, because what's relevant is getting that convoy across the ocean?
I don't recall one off the top of my head. I've been trying to think through my collection, but I think where the hobby has lacked is actually those types of games. Air warfare games and naval games in particular have always focused on the hardware. So you find a bajillion tactical systems, and you don't find too many campaign systems. When you do find the campaign systems, it gets abstracted out, and you're not even really fighting a combat game. It's a subset to something else. Some games, I'm trying to remember here, I think it was Line of Battle, I think it was Omega Games, again, Steven Newberg, I think, was a designer. Don't quote me on this, but they had rules for, hey, when you reach a certain point of your ship's, now you have to talk about withdrawing. There was no fighting to the death. They actually had some rules to try to get you to encourage you to save your ships and not be that, last man standing sort of piece, to try to create some of that, remind you of some of that more realistic conditions. But campaign wise, I got to say, Blue Water Navy, that's part of what impressed me about it, is that it reframed why you were fighting and really brought it to the front. And like I said, the Fleet series had it there. It wasn't as explicit, but it was there. And those are good games because sometimes you need that reminder of why you're fighting, not just that you're out there just to, hoorah, let's go sink the battleship.
Yeah, you mentioned, thinking back through the games in your collection. I was just eyeballing my big game shelf across the room here from where I'm recording. And so I have a sum total of two games that you could legitimately classify as naval games, and even one of those is a stretch. I have a copy of The Pacific War from Lock and Load, and I have a copy of Blackbeard from GMT. That's the extent of my naval war gameness up here in the game den. That's it. Like, that's all I got. I'm not even sure I have a copy of Battleship in the house, quite frankly. That's how non-naval war game-ish I am. So,
But that's actually, I think, where the modern day, you talk about the new wave of gaming, and that's where I think the new wave of gaming is going to make some differences, because you may not be a naval gamer, but if they can integrate the naval game in with something else, the whole multi-domain pieces, I think then it makes sense, and we're going to see more of that. I mean, even in the air warfare pieces, take a look at, again, I keep going back to the Downtown series, a great series, because it's Lee Brimacom Wood's raid series. You're doing a raid. In Red Storm, Douglas Bush's version, you're fighting over the Warsaw Pact and NATO over the Fulda Gap or something like that. But you have a mission. You have to go off. You're trying to execute the mission. You're trying to get through the defenses. But at the end of the day, it all comes down to, I'm supporting something else. I'm not just doing this just for giggles. I'm trying to do something out of this. If there's a mission behind it, why I'm putting together this strike package. And I think that's part of the evolution of gaming that we've seen that makes today's games in some ways a lot more interesting, if not a bit more abstract, but it's still a lot more interesting than what we may have had back in the 70s and the 80s.
Yeah, you mentioned, so just it popped to mind as we were talking there for a second ago. There is one particular game out there that is sort of convoy focused. That's the PQ-17 game. But even that one, I think, still gets back to your point of, it's a tactical game. Like, you're worried about the fuel in individual ships and can they get all the way to Murmansk. But it's not the campaign to get convoys across the Atlantic in World War II. It's a very, you know, ship-specific model, just with a convoy objective rather than a sink-the-battleship kind of objective. Bart, as we're talking about the operational campaign-level purpose of why that naval fight is going on, what have you guys done, if anything, along those lines in the command scenarios that you've been working on?
I was just going to add in, when you're talking about the campaign games that rely on the sort of getting the convoys through and all that sort of thing, there's some Pacific War games that do that pretty well. The old SPI USN, I think, did, and the computer versions of that War in the Pacific by Grigsby, I think, and for a while there, Admiral's Edition of War in the Pacific was called Logistics in the Pacific. So, they do exist. But to follow on your question about what we're doing with the Northern Fury series and Command, I mapped out the strategic operational sort of backdrop to it. I know the operational moves that are going to be happening and all the tactical scenarios are built to feed that. Like, there'll be amphibious operations against Iceland and Norway eventually, American and NATO. And then when we get into the other theaters, there's quite a bit of that stuff. So in addition to protecting the convoys, protecting the air bridge, there'll be the getting the troops on shore aspect of things. So that is woven in to virtually every scenario, a good portion of the scenarios anyway. So trying to fit it in.
Yeah, with you being, you know, like a scenario designer on those things, I wasn't sure how much of that you guys might have explicitly built into some of the scenarios you were working on to sort of capture that spirit of what Ian was describing there from the bigger picture. So
I've got one command scenario. It's reputed to be the largest command scenario ever built. It's called the Longest Battle, and it covers 35 days, and it's all about getting convoys across the Atlantic. It is very tricky to build a scenario that length in command. At least with my skill in scripting and the state of the game when I built it about probably 4 years ago now. So we do build specific scenarios for that, but mostly it's tactical scenarios with an operational backdrop. And I try and paint that operational backdrop in the briefings and some of the messages and some of the side missions. For instance, in the Indian Ocean you as Commander Fifth Fleet have to take a side trip to Ethiopia for negotiations with various political elements. You've got to secure the site, that sort of thing. So try and build in that bigger picture backdrop whenever we can, because it's fundamental to the story, I think.
Yeah, and you know, obviously it's pretty story driven for the way you guys attack these things. So
yeah.
So that's pretty important there. We're at an hour and change at this point of recording time. By the time I edit this down and work around some of the technical glitches we've had, we're going to come in a little under an hour, but that's fine, right? You know, it's what we aim for. That's what we'll see what we can come up with. But I promised you guys I was only going to keep you around an hour, so I don't want to overstay our welcome here. I do want to ask Ian, parting shots on this here, but in terms of Cold War wargaming kind of having this bit of a renaissance, it's been very heavily land combat oriented, with a few exceptions like Blue Water Navy or the Red Storm or NATO Air Commander. What do you think might be the next cool thing or the next thing that's going to make people pay attention to Cold War wargaming outside of land combat that we should be looking forward to, paying attention to, holding our breath for?
Wow, good question. I think I'm not sure that the next best thing is actually on the horizon out there. I think what we're going to see here is exactly what Compass Games is doing. They're going to take the old system, the Fleet Series in this case, that pretty good reputation, and reskin it and update it and such. But at the end of the day, I think what's going to happen is people are going to recognize that a lot of the games that are out there really are too stovepiped. And I think people are going to start looking for that game out there that's going to bring together the multi-domains. How they're going to do that, I have no idea. But the Cold War game that can bring together... So, I mean, we've had some attempts at it. I mean, laugh if you want, but TAC Air from Avalon Hill in the 80s was the air-land battle game. So it was heavy on the air side, but it did have the land battle in there. Can we get the same version of that for something for the Navy air integration piece that isn't bogged down in the tactical? The other angle that we may see, which I would really enjoy to see, is actually a strategic game of naval warfare during the Cold War. There's only one title that I know of out there, Sea Power in the State by Sim Canada back in like 82 or something like that. That's the only strategic level World War III type game that I know of. I think that's an area that's ripe for some exploration. Let's see it on the global scale. What did it look like? Not tactical. Let's look at the big picture. Plenty of nukes to fly around in that one, I'm sure.
Yeah. Bart, give us the preview of what's next in your scenario pack that you're building and working on there. What are we going to see coming out for CMO here off of the drawing board?
Yeah, so the next on the horizon, I'm in the testing phase, or finalizing the testing of two scenarios. One of them is Borscht on Bornholm, which you play as the Russians, and you're obviously doing an airborne and an amphibious landing on Bornholm Island in the Baltic. I'm also wrapping up the testing on a fairly large one. It's called Tour de Force. It's four carriers, four U.S. carriers, actually a fifth one coming in, two Brit and two French carriers holding the Russians hostage in the North Sea. I've got two Caribbean Fury scenarios in the works. One is an attempt to get a coin battle going in the area of Belize. Another one is a strategic strike on Russian elements in Venezuela without bringing Venezuela into the war. So that one's kind of interesting. And then next one is, after that, is going to be to the Mediterranean, where I've got the Nimitz coming in from Suez, taking over from various units in supporting Turkey. So those are the four or five I've got on the works right now. But I've got to start the Pacific sooner rather than later. And I've been working a little bit on that. So, busy enough.
Do you sleep?
Barely. I'm of an age now where I don't get much, but yeah.
Just wondering. It's like, yeah, I don't have much coming, just these nine things I'm working on, you know.
Yeah, it's the writing that's taking a bit of a backseat. As I mentioned, your army is keeping Joel very busy. So he's looking at a break come next summer when he moves jobs. Until then, I've taken the lead on doing the writing, and he's editing that. So it's a bit of a role reversal, and working on this novella, which will be out this winter. It's a much smaller project and should fill out some of the gaps. But busy enough.
Sounds excellent. We will definitely keep our eyes out for it. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us tonight, for fighting through a couple of technical glitches here. I appreciate you helping us kick off our new season of Mention and Dispatches in Style with a topic we, quite frankly, have never really covered much on the podcast. Because it's not something that's in the wheelhouse of too many of our core group. So thank you for jumping in on something that you guys know way more about than the rest of us, and I really appreciate it. Ian, thank you. Appreciate you joining us. Hope everybody swings by and follows you on Twitter, and if they're not, they're wrong. But thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
And Bart, we're looking forward to reading some stuff once you guys are able to finally spit it back out, and when the next batch of CMO scenarios finally drops. But I have a feeling we're keeping you from finishing a half a dozen of them right now just through the course of this podcast. So appreciate you taking the time to be here.
Well, thank you very much for having us, yeah.
Cool. And audience, thank you for joining us. This is the first of what will be a dozen or more episodes of Season 5 of Mention and Dispatches as we kick off the fall, barreling towards the winter. What we do have coming up this season... we'll be talking with the guys from Georgetown University Wargaming Society. We've got some folks coming in to talk space combat. We haven't talked space stuff much at all, and so we've got some folks that are going to come in and talk about some different space combat stuff along the way. Sometime this fall, the Compass Games catalog is going to show up, and there's no way we're not going to cover that, so that'll be coming along somewhere. And of course, because we are the Armchair Dragoons, we can't get away with ignoring the Age of Gunpowder. So we've already got a couple of those on the board as well that we're going to circle back around to. So thank you all for joining us. Thank you to my guests tonight. And thank you especially to the audience for sticking with us through all of this.